Yes, we tend to think of ourselves as a coastal nation, perhaps true, going by settlement density, but it's the rivers and their tributaries that give us life, that is, that are the lifeblood of Australia, to borrow the subtitle of my last guest's book today. Historian Ian Hoskins was given the enviable task by the National Library of Australia to travel round the country exploring our rivers. And as he says, he was taken to places he'd never dreamt of going. Lucky him. And after those experiences, he says he has learned something about our rivers. Well, by reading his finished publication, Rivers, The Lifeblood of Australia, he's indeed learned a great deal about the complexity of our rivers, about their history, their beauty, the expectations we have of them, the politics they inspire, but the lack of romanticism we have about them, which Don Watson writes about in his foreword. Then there's the people who've documented and told the stories of that lifeblood. He's also charted, I might add, a great Australian travel story. So Ian Hoskins, a very warm welcome to Saturday Extra from an envious presenter.
Thank you, Geraldine. Thanks for having me.
What a wonderful sort of mission to try to explore this.
It was. I got the email request on the same day that I had a contract accepted for another book, A History of Australia and the Pacific, which I was looking forward to writing. And suddenly this came in, and I only had a year to write it. So this one got precedent, but the wonder was mixed with a degree of anxiety and urgency. Yes, I had to plot my path around Australia very quickly.
Yes, and we'll come to that in just a moment. But I do just want to dwell for a moment on that Don Watson remark that, you know, they romanticise, the Americans romanticise, you know, oh, Shenandoah, I love to see you, and so on and so forth. And, you know, what they think about the Mississippi, you know, is just extraordinary when you see it. Why don't we do that really here?
Well, we do. We do in part. Don Watson had a wonderful turn of phrase in his book, The Bush, where he was referring mainly to the rivers of the Murray-Darling system, where we turn them into essentially machines because they're so regulated, a series of, particularly on the Murray, dams and weirs and all sorts of things. But when you look into the poetry of that, you know, flourishing period at the end of the 19th century, Patterson and Lawson are the best known, but there are many others besides. You do see that rivers turn up in that all those drovers' songs and poems and stories or whatever. They're there, the Diamantina, the Barcoo, the Lachlan, because these are the features of the landscape that orientate city dwellers who are reading those poems in large part. That's far western New South Wales. That's where the sheep are. Yeah. So the hurrah boys, let's head off to the Lachlan. So there is a great deal of romanticisation of the rivers there, and that was part of the story I wanted to tell, because the bush, this big term, refers to vegetation, literally shrubs and trees, but rivers are part of the bush, of course. So there's that almost hidden feature of our bush poetry and eulogisation.
No, yes, I can hear him already criticising us, because I think romanticisation, I'm not even sure it's a word. Let's call it romanticising and eulogising.
Yeah, well, I was thinking of eulogising, yeah, thank you. But what we do, and I suspect what the Americans do too, Hoover Dam being an example, is that we can love a river, we being European Australians, and then we can just turn it into a machine and without thinking twice. And the best example of that is the Snowy. I mean, goodness me. So that the Snowy has this great wall built at Jindabyne, and it's starved of water and the lower reaches. And yet we still celebrate the Snowy. And that contradiction was an interesting one to explore, where the power of the mythology fuels the conservation campaign in the 80s and 90s and whatever to restore at least some part of the flow of the Snowy.
Yes. Look, in fact, you do talk about, you become fascinated with the thin blue lines that crisscrossed our map that gave you a sort of abstract impression, just to develop this theme you're mentioning, of a vast organism kept alive by the blue veins, the capillaries and the arteries of our rivers. And that is not something we necessarily associate with the driest continent on the planet, do we?
No. The subtitle of the book, Lifeblood, I think at the time they suggested Lifeblood of a Nation, I thought, oh, good, that sounds a bit cliched. I'm not sure if I'm too keen on that. Went away and thought about it. Opened a large atlas that I had inherited from an aunt, 1968, Reader's Digest, who produced some really super publications and certainly did back in the day. These are folio-sized pages just of Australia. So each map was incredibly detailed. And when I looked at that to think, how do I begin, I was struck, just as you said, by all the blue lines. Now, not all of them are running all the time, because then I looked at the key to these maps and there's perennial and non-perennial rivers, there are washes, there are creeks, there are swamps. We didn't use the term wetland back then. Things were swamps. But all are depicted with these little illustrations and codes. And I realised, goodness, that this is a dry country that at times can be awash with water. And Dorothea McKellar's phrase is already entering into the minds of many of your listeners, you know, a land of drought and flooding rain. And that's the case, And Jill Kerr Conway's book, I looked at that, her memoir of her life and her times at Kurrain. She talks about the magical transformation of the landscape around the river, which would be dry for much of the year and then suddenly come to life with the water. And it made sense of the Aboriginal earth ovens that were dotted along the waterways, because Aboriginal people knew that, and they'd built their ovens for baking seeds and all sorts of things, which were dormant for much of the year, or maybe two or three years indeed. But then they knew to go back there, and that's where the water and that's where the food was.
How much did exploring this change your views about the relationship of Indigenous peoples to the rivers?
Oh, I mean, I had a very clear sense that Aboriginal people adapted to the landscape. I think possibly I thought they simply adapted to the landscape, so therefore the landscape was everything. Two things stuck in my mind. One is the creation stories across the country, of course, where these large figures that emerge, whether they be serpents or whatever, are engineering the landscape before people come, and thereby bequeath a pre-existing landscape to Aboriginal people, namely the rivers. You know, so they've all been hewn out of the earth. In the case of the Murray, it was a great big Murray cod that was flapping along and created the pathway of that waterway. So there's that. So the engineering that we white Australians partake of over the last 200 years has already happened before people turn up in Aboriginal mythology, creation stories, but also that they weren't entirely passive. I mean, they were more mobile than Europeans who set down towns and settlements, and those get washed away periodically, Gundagai being a good example in the mid-19th century. They could move around, and I'm sure they could tell when trouble was coming, and they could pull up tent peg, so to speak, and head off somewhere else to safe ground and then return. But they were also capable of engineering the landscape too. So it wasn't I didn't want to partake in that romanticization, got the word right there, of Aboriginal people who just simply trod lightly on the land. Down around Lake Condar in Victoria, there's evidence of a really complex system of aquaculture where they basically farmed eels, for goodness sake. You know, they were digging out channels there. Now, how they did that without metal implements it beggars my imagination, but they did, and they must have moved tons of earth to do so.
Well, look, what struck me was the fact that the Indigenous people had different names for the rivers at different points of the river. It wasn't, whereas we tended to do, you know, the Murray, the Murrumbidgee, whatever. I mean, that's
yes,
the Snowy. So, indicates quite a different attitude to the river.
Well, it does, but it indicates that that lots of people are living along the river at different points, and each has a specific relationship to that point. And they don't. I mean, of course, Aboriginal people ventured far beyond their territory, but they did so according to protocols. But that was where they lived was their territory, and they inhabited that with a series of important stories and protocols. So they had a name for that patch of the river. The Murray is a great example. I mean, goodness, there are there are well over a dozen Aboriginal groups along the Murray, and we Hamilton Hume names it the Hume River in the early 1820s, and then it's subsequently named the Murray. So we just give it one name, but that doesn't detract from the fact that every river has different identities, and the Murray. Well, here's another revelation for me. Going to near the origin of the Murray, I didn't quite get to the little spring bursting out of Forest Hill. I couldn't manage that one. But fairly well up in the high country, there is a waterway which you can throw a stone across, and it ends up to be the Murray at the Coorong, you know, this great, sluggish, wide waterway. So there's a feature with many identities. And that alerted me to the idea that, I don't know, rivers are perhaps unique, or they're almost like air, because they're not one thing, and they travel across vast extents of land, and therefore they join those people and those ecosystems at the top of the waterway with those at the bottom of the waterway. Simply, if nothing else, by the fact that if you stop the water flow at the top of the waterway or at some point along it with a dam, or with irrigation extraction or whatever, you profoundly affect the ecology and the people who are living at the bottom. South Australians know that well
indeed, we know that. Look, in the few minutes I have, I just would love you to tell us the story, if you could, about the combo waterhole in the Channel Country, because you chunk all the rivers in the Channel Country in central Queensland.
Yeah.
And it's very moving.
It is. Anyone who's seen my workplace knows I'm not a particularly well-organised person, but I did manage to squeeze in all these trips across the country, just jumping into a hired car and racing off. And so I did that for the Channel Country, flew to Brisbane and then headed off in a hired car just on my own. And I'm not a man of the land by any means, so I was hoping that all would go well, and it essentially did. But I was driving along, and I was aware that in the middle of the Channel Country, the chapter I use to describe our European mythology of the land, if you like, because it's Burke and Wills and there's Banjo Patterson's Waltzing Matilda has its origins there. And I knew that there was an actual waterway, a billabong, and it was called Combo. And I got to a T-junction, and my plan had been to head to the right towards Winton and then on to Longreach. It was getting towards the end of the day, and I thought I might just be able to manage the 70 Ks up there. I don't have time to get fuel first, but if I go for it and I'm lucky, I'll do it at sunset, or at as the sun was in that beautiful golden twilight time. And I managed to do that, but I got more and more anxious as the needle got lower and lower.
But the point is, you had emus running beside you, and you got to this waterhole, waterhole.
The new Lansborough Highway is this expanse of tarmac. I took the old Lansborough Highway to save some time and fuel, and it's a dirt track. And I was there, I was looking at emus and brolgas. It was almost mystical. And I got to this place, and there was the golden light of the end of the day amongst the Mitchell grass, and I just walked, a soul being, to that waterhole, which was well signposted, but no one else around.
Wow.
And it was really, really moving.
Okay.
And then, believe it or not, I got back in the car, and there was a plains turkey just flying beside me, a bustard flying beside me as I took off to confront a very anxious trip back to Winton with the needle
petrol.
On empty.
All right, Ian, look, we'll have to go. But look, it's a beautiful book. It's called,
Thank you
really
so much.
Is, Rivers, The Lifeblood of Australia, published by the National Library.